Postseason baseball is here, and it is the absolute best time of the year. I'm Rob Bradford of Baseballs and Boring, and we're going to have you covered every step of the way with instant reactions from players and coaches and managers and fans and reporters and everybody else who is immersed in this awesomeness and all the craziness that comes with October baseball. So follow Baseballs and Boring in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It was on an October day last year, people living in apartment blocks located in a coastal area of South Athens in Greece, they had to be evacuated.
So near their homes, work on a huge urban development was underway. It was stalled after a frightening discovery. In addition to the evacuations, traffic in the area was diverted.
Now, by this point, you're probably wondering what exactly it was. Well, it wasn't zombies or aliens or the Loch Ness Monster.
Or even boring furniture.
Or any of the other things that we've covered on this podcast before. And according to the Associated Press, it was a 500-pound bomb dating back to World War II.
I saw this article last year, and it made me wonder how often this happens in Europe.
Well, the answer is surprisingly often. And we spoke with Matthew Osborne of the FBI. Now, you just heard from one of our producers, Lauren, and I'm your host, Mike Rogers. This is Something Offbeat. What was your first reaction when you heard of this story?
Probably a little different than yours or others, just because this is a fairly common occurrence every day all over Europe from World War II. Many areas that were barraged during World War II from aerial ordnance or bombs, there's every day. England has many problems, does UXO almost on a daily basis. So it wasn't that surprising. I think it got the news coverage just because they were building a pretty expansive urban expansion to do apartments and some other things. So that, of course, alarms everybody when their house is about to be there and a 500-pound bomb was found where it was at.
Are they still dangerous all this time later? What percentage could still detonate?
Don't know on the percentage, just because we don't really know how many are out there. Millions of pounds of ordnance was dropped during World War II. But I will tell you, there was an instance in England around a very populated area in February of last year. You can look it up. It's a pretty amazing drone footage from Twitter. But they found a very similar, I'm assuming similar bomb to this, about the same size, 500 pounds. And they were preparing to try and take care of it the same as the Greek army did. And they had what they describe as an unplanned detonation. And the bomb detonated. And luckily, all the protective measures they had put into place before the bomb detonated, basically there were very, very few injuries I was able to research. And I was able to find no deaths from it, which is pretty amazing from if you watch the footage.
Do some of these devices lose a little of their punch with the passage of time?
They can, just because of moisture can get into them and then things start to break down just depending on the explosive filler that was used. But the problem is you don't know. And many of the times these have a very common color code and it's called rust. And that is not listed in any explosive ordnance disposal publication as something to determine filler. So a lot of the problem comes from the technicians that work on these. They really don't know what it is other than size and what type it is, and then they just have to go worst case with what it could possibly be.
What could potentially set one of these off? Just if it's buried, let's say a tractor goes over it or something, I mean, what could cause it to detonate?
That normally was what we would see here in the U.S. up till about probably the 1930s, 1940s from Civil War ordnance. Due to the age of most of the explosive that was used during our ordnance from the Civil War, that doesn't happen as much. The issue that you have over in Europe is these things, depending on how they, we have a term in explosive ordnance disposal. My former job before coming to the FBI was one of those that we called it porpoising, which is where a bomb can come in and basically comes back out of the ground, goes back in, because once it hits the ground, it does different things. So someone could, in effect, come across a tractor or something else when they're digging and hit the fusing section, which could cause a detonation to it.
When I read this story, it also made me curious if any bombs might be hiding here in the U.S.
And I'm pretty curious about that, too.
Osborne will get to that in a minute, but I've got to share some of the research I found when I was looking into these forgotten bombs. They're an issue all over the world.
You know, it's not something that is discussed a whole lot, but yeah, I guess anywhere there's been significant bombing in the past, this could pop up.
Right. For example, Al Jazeera reported last June that 50 years after the Vietnam conflict, bombs from the ordeal are still killing people in Vietnam and Laos.
And sadly, that barely scratches the surface.
Yeah. In a report on cluster bombs and landmines in Kosovo, the International Committee of the Red Cross said that virtually all armed conflicts in modern times have left problems of explosive ordnance in their wake. Now, thankfully, in the U.S., there hasn't been that type of warfare in some time.
How many of these do you think are lurking here in the U.S., and how old would they be? Or do we have to go back to the Civil War?
We do. I think it'd be irresponsible to put a number on it. I just know that there are much higher concentrations in Civil War areas, especially places like Gettysburg and others that had very heavy artillery that was used. Most of the ordnance that was used during the Civil War had a very similar composition in its filler. And when exposed to moisture, it can break down. The problem is there are also other pieces of ordnance used during Civil War that were made specifically to be protected against this. So there's no way of telling how sensitive or insensitive the explosives are. And really, the only way is when they get uncovered to see how many are actually out there.
Is it safe to say that a lot of these will never be discovered?
I think that would be a safe assumption. Our other issue that we have in the United States right now is just from the different wars since World War II that we've been involved with have been that we get a lot of, when I was an active Army EOD tech, we would get a lot of war souvenirs, we'll call them. Grandpa in World War II or uncle in Vietnam brought something back that maybe didn't go off as it was supposed to. And the assumption from the layman is, well, it didn't go off, so it's safe. And then grandfather or uncle or aunt or whoever passes away, and then no one feels comfortable with it, and you find it's actually a live mortar, projectile. Grenades are the most common thing because they look the coolest and they're the easiest to get back. So now with the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, those are things that your active EOD and your public safety bomb technician are having to deal with quite a bit more with finding those out and about.
Does this go hand in hand with landmines, or is that a completely different issue?
I think it's a completely different issue just because we haven't used them on our soil. So that's where we don't have the same issue that some areas do in the South Pacific and in South America, or even over in former World War II spots where just areas were just completely mined and saturated with them. We don't have that same issue here in the United States.
So when you find one of these, what is involved in defusing it, as it were? Like, what did the Greeks have to do to this one they found?
So they described theirs, and I wasn't able to dig into exactly what they did. They said they used a non-detonation render safe. So when we take something and make it safer, we have a procedure we call a render safe. Well, my job currently as a bomb technician, ordnance is not really what we do. That's why there's two separate entities. The military has explosive ordnance disposal. That is a 26-week-long course. Eglin Air Force Base, run by the Navy, all four services go to it, and it's in the name, ordnance disposal. So that was in my training in that former life. Three-quarters of the school is dedicated to all the piece of ordnance. As far as for the hazardous devices school, our concentration is on making sure they understand the safeties and the importance of being the first responder to that, getting an accurate description and getting it off to an EOD operator to safely dispose of it. Because we basically, it's the difference between 26 weeks of training and 2 hours of training on ordnance. There's no way that to possibly in the 6 weeks that we have with HDS bring public safety bomb techs to the competence level. So we try and enforce safety.
I have to admit, when he was talking about that, I was kind of picturing like an action movie montage.
I was too. One of my favorite bomb defusing scenes, I think it was one of the Die Hard movies. Bruce Willis had to defuse a bomb by placing exactly 4 gallons of water on a scale, but he was only given 2 containers, one that held 3 gallons and the other one that held 5. So it's like a brain teaser.
That's an algebra problem I wouldn't want to have to solve. I'm bad at math when I'm under pressure.
I will share the solution with you a little bit later.
You even asked Osborne how defusing bombs in real life compares to the movies.
Is this job as nerve-wracking as it is?
Postseason baseball is here, and it is the absolute best time of the year. I'm Rob Bradford of Baseballs and Boring, and we're going to have you covered every step of the way with instant reactions from players and coaches and managers and fans and reporters and everybody else who is immersed in this awesomeness and all the craziness that comes with October baseball. So follow Baseballs and Boring in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Is made to appear on TV and in the movies with sweat pouring down people's faces and their hands shaking.
Well, my current job right now, I guess we have a saying, it's better to be a has-been than it ever was. My primary job is an instructor right now. Do have some operational capabilities. I will say with the two deployments, I did active duty one to Fallujah 03-04 and then to the Syrian border 05-06. Those times could get pretty hairy, and there were definitely some times when I was wondering what the decisions, why I ever left the infantry and the army. Definitely was.
Should people be worried about some of these randomly going off? In other words, nothing really triggers them necessarily. They just explode.
For the most part, explosives don't normally just spontaneously detonate. It takes some sort of trigger. And typically the way that ordnance is made, you have a primary explosive that then sets off a secondary charge, which is normally your main charge. Those are pretty insensitive. So for the most part, there really isn't a worry other than there's some physical action that happens. And normally that's when we find them, when you're clearing a formerly used defense site, something was an aerial artillery range, and now they're going to put a neighborhood there. Well, a company's hired to come in, scan the ground, dispose of anything they find, but sometimes they miss things. So I'd say that's the biggest hazard, is when digging in these spots where ordnance was heavily used before. But as far as randomly going off, that danger is pretty minimal.
Is that where most of these are? Are they buried?
Yes, definitely.
Have you heard of any of them ever going off in a populated area, maybe in a city?
So all the ones that I'm aware of that have happened, that have gone off in a populated city, were due to the human being that was doing something that we in our field deem they shouldn't. Many believe that because of the amount of time that the Civil War ordnance or other ordinances stayed in the ground and nothing's happened, that it's fine. So you've had all the way up through 3 or 4 years ago, people that inert, which is basically making them safe, removing the explosive hazard out of the materials. Every now and then you find these collectors that in a neighborhood, they're putting a drill into a cannonball in their garage and it detonates. And it still goes to show that it's why we, as when I was EOD and public safety bomb techs, it's not something we do as far as inerting. We just try and dispose of it.
As an instructor, what are you looking for in someone who wants to get into this area? What's the most important thing that someone needs to have?
I would say that we have a common misconception in our field that we're kind of some screws loose, we're crazy, just adrenaline junkies. And I'd say, if anything, the best bomb techs and EOD operators I've ever run into. Opposite. They are skilled decision makers. They're very good at making decisions by taking in all the variables and coming up with logical courses of action. The worst thing you can do as a bomb tech is make as rash decisions and have it based on ego or adrenaline, because ultimately it can cost you your life.
It's really interesting stuff. And it's kind of scary, too. I mean, how many of them could be out there, right?
Appreciate it, sir. I'd be more worried about driving in New York City than I would be about just walking around in a random Civil War ordnance going off.
All right, so you ready for the solution to the whole filling up the 5-gallon container with water?
Yes, I love Die Hard. I'm ready for it.
Okay. You fill up the 3-gallon container and you pour it into the 5-gallon container. Then okay. You fill up the 3-gallon container again and you top off the 5-gallon container. Then you empty out the 5-gallon container. You pour the 3-gallon container. Oh, I don't know. I knew the answer. I had it. And God, I'd be terrible. We'd be dead.
Thank God for people like Osborne from the FBI and, of course, John McClane for saving us all from bombs. Because, you don't want this team on it.
Lauren, thanks so much. I'm Mike Rogers, and thank you for listening to Something Offbeat. This episode written and produced by Lauren Barry and Chris Blake. Audio editing by Chris Blake. Original music by Myron Kaplan, and editorial support from Cooper Mall. To keep listening, please subscribe. subscribe to us on the Odyssey app, or Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have your own offbeat story that you think we should cover, send it to us at somethingoffbeat@Odyssey. That's AUDACY.com.
Postseason baseball is here, and it is the absolute best time of the year. I'm Rob Bradford of Baseballs and Boring, and we're going to have you covered every step of the way with instant reactions from players and coaches and managers and fans and reporters and everybody else who is immersed in this awesomeness and all the craziness that comes with October baseball. So follow Baseballs and Boring in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.